to a new episode of the Divorce Coaching Podcast with me, Tom Nash, Mr. Divorce Coach, and your host. I haven't been doing these for a little while, but we're picking these back up and to continue with the theme of sharing other people's stories, other people's lived experiences of their own divorce, separation, breakup, and all the things that they go through practically, emotionally, etc. I'm actually joined by a very good friend of mine, I hope you won't mind me mentioning, a client of mine as well, Andrew. Hi, Andrew. How are you doing?
Hi. Fine. Thanks, Tom.
Andrew's very kindly decided and offered to join us today on the podcast. He's going to be talking a bit about his experience of his lived his background and what he went through in his own divorce. I'm going to be talking about what helped, what worked, what didn't. Obviously, before we began working together, Andrew, can you just tell us a little bit about the story, obviously keeping confidentialities and things like that, but about what was happening for you at that time?
Yeah, I think when I was introduced to you, Tom, I think I was in a pretty low place, and I was what I would best describe as being a spinning top. I just didn't know where to go or what to turn, except for the fact I was running up huge costs with my lawyers, I suppose using them almost as inadvertently as therapy for the situation. Without sort of trying to suggest one side's right and one side's wrong, I was in the situation whereby I had been forced to leave the matrimonial home in a hurry. I was staying at my father's in what can best be described as the smallest box room in England. I had very little access to my sons. I was trying to keep my sons and my ex-wife afloat financially while still meeting all the other needs, and constantly being told that it was not enough. And I know you know this, but I mean, I was paying a significant sum of money to do that. And I was being, at best, maligned within my own social group, with my own children, in the whole position. And really, I was at a point where I just couldn't take the stress. I wasn't necessarily sure that even my reactions and responses were appropriate or right, not just in the context of the divorce, but as a human being as well. And I didn't know to what extent, you know, my responses to things were valid or not valid, because it had all just become too much of a blur, too many things, too many emotions, too many stresses to really focus.
Yeah. So how were you coping? Well, what were you using in terms of coping mechanisms, and what was getting you through every day? Because it's horrible. I remember it. It's soul destroying.
So, you know, my background is that many years ago I trained as a lawyer, and now I'm a finance guy. So my process try and just document everything and argue the point and show the injustice of everything, which is I spent an enormous amount of time documenting, but for very little purpose. And then the temptation is to document, but it doesn't really matter a whole heap of figs in the end of the day. And then the other thing was that every time I had a moment of crisis or resistance, or my ex-partner was one of those individuals who was never ever going to sit down and negotiate and cooperate and see and try to see across the bridge that divided us effectively. Yeah. And because of that, me being a bit of a soft touch, I should imagine, because I miss my children and this was not a situation I wanted to be in. And I genuinely think that, you know, I'm a reasonably nice guy. I can stand a lot next to other people as a reasonably nice guy. So I was a soft touch. So I was all forever giving in and then trying to deal with the consequences of giving in, or having to speak to my lawyers. Say, I just can't. This is just nonsense. This is ridiculous. I've got this accusation. I've got that accusation. I've got this. So I was also then spending a fortune in lawyers. So my two coping mechanisms were basically my legal firm, who were great. But my legal firm and me just having to sit there and document things. I mean, you know, you hear these horrible stories of people who unfortunately sort of start to drink too much or sort of become obsessive about certain things. I didn't do any of that except to be an obsessive documenter. But I was struggling. I mean, I'd really got to the point where I was struggling. I mean, as terms of a support network, you know, I'd worked a long time overseas, so most of my friends and colleagues that I would have normally been able to sit out with, that they're all, you know, in Australia, the US, the Middle East. So I didn't have that support network. I was with my dad, who's a great person, but very old school. You know, his sort of comment was, "I won't put up with it, son," and that was it. You know, and so there was nobody else in a support network for me that I could rely on to help me talk it out.
Yeah.
So
that documenting, knowing you like I do, I mean, that was quite a cathartic process for you, wasn't it? Because it was around trying to get things out of your head, make things real, justify them, try and bring some justice towards them. It was very much a strong coping mechanism for you to kind of create what the knowledge and put it into kind of data in effect, wasn't it?
Yeah, there was. I mean, there were just, and even now, even though I was documenting like crazy, I haven't documented everything. There were just so many things happening that I had to document them, A, to remember them initially, but B, then to sort of make sure that I understood the narrative, because I'm being gaslit all the time in this whole process. You know, you said this, you did that, and there was, because there was so many things going on. You know, 6 weeks later, I wouldn't be able to remember exactly what had happened or the sequence or what was said. So it was a coping, but it was definitely a coping mechanism. It was a way of sort of trying to make sense of what was going on. And again, Tom, you know me, and you've seen me in connection on these things later. You know, I'm a person who thinks and operates and rationalizes verbally. And written word. So that's my sort of process for how I build up an idea and how I build up thoughts and get myself to the place that I needed to be. But even then, prior to speaking with you, Tom, I even that wasn't working at that point.
Yeah, yeah, okay. So let's take that then. At that point, right, just before you were kind of referred, because it was actually the law firm, wasn't it?
That was probably the single best thing that my law firm did. I ended up speaking with the senior partner at the law firm, or a senior partner at the law firm, because of the amount of issues that were just arising every week. And she was sort of saying, you know, you need to step back, and this is just part of the process. And of course, that's an easy and probably right thing to say from a legal point of view, but from a human point of view, you just can't. When it's your children in the balance, when you're being maligned to your children, when you're basically earning a good salary but broke every moment because you're pumping it in to try and support them, and you just can't just step back and be relaxed. And I think she recognized that. And it was she who sort of suggested I speak to you. And I'll be honest, you know, when somebody says to you, "Oh, you know, speak to a divorce coach," my first thought, being a man of the generation I am, is, well, that sounds a little bit, a lot of new age nonsense. You know, but I'd reached a point where, you know, in for a penny, in for a pound, I'm let me have the call. Let me see if there's something in there that can help me. Which is what I did. But that actually referencing me to you was probably the single biggest thing that my law firm actually did for me, because the rest of the time, going back to what I said before, I was largely rewriting and editing their letters to try and make sure that the points that I was, you know, I did a lot of, they did my legal work in terms of understanding the mechanics, but a lot of my actual correspondence was largely written by me, because they couldn't get over what I wanted to say as well as I wanted to say it.
Yeah. I mean, I know your law firm. We're not going to mention, but I know that they're a fantastic law firm. And I think that, just to caveat what you're saying, I suppose a little bit, the legal work, I suppose, from what you're saying, the legal work, absolutely outstanding, super. It was more about, I suppose, what I'm kind of picking out from here is, was it about taking the different resources and making them more efficient in their areas? So really focus on the legal with the lawyer. Take the therapy part out, like you said.
Exactly, that was it. And so, like, going back to what I just said there before, that the lawyers are great from a legal point of view. They need, because there's obviously so much going on in my life, they needed me to write narrative that they could They knew the argument, but they needed me to put the narrative in. But what they stopped being at that point was also my emotional crutch, because inadvertently they had become my emotional crutch, and that could stop, and I could then start to focus and deal with, first of all, heavily leaning on you, but I think, you know, learning enough to be able to also help myself to stand up back on my feet. So I think that's really, really what I would like to say if I was putting it down on a strap line.
No, I like that. That's very nicely put. You've always had a great way of words. It's all about documenting and literature. So how would you describe, in your own words, how would you describe the mixture, like the melting pot of all those feelings and emotions that you're experiencing at that point of struggling? Like what how would you label them? What were they? Would you describe it as a mixture?
It was a mixture, but it was largely, and there was all sorts of different things. It was a mixture of fear, there was anxiety, and I'm driven. I have a real sense of justice, not just for me, but for everybody. And the for everybody part is a bit where, you know, I don't do myself any justice, or I don't do myself any favors, because that extends actually to my ex, who was incredibly adversarial. There were times when, you know, inverted commas, I could have gone for could have pulled the trigger and really gone for it, but I didn't think that was fair.
Yeah.
But the thing that was really bothering me was the fact that I was still being represented as being unfair when I was actually trying to go the extra mile. So yeah, it was anxiety, it was fear, frustration around this injustice, and frustration at the amount of time and contact I was being allowed to my own children. That was absolutely, you know, I'd gone from being, prior to this, I'd been, you know, again, I've got to be careful because, you know, other sides will have different views. But in my view, I'd been sort of effectively a full-time father. And, you know, I've been getting up in the morning, I've been making the breakfast, I've been preparing lunches, I've been, you know, ironing the school uniforms, I've been, you know, bath times for the youngest one, I'd been doing homework with the elder one, I'd been, you know, I'd gone from that.
Yeah.
And that, from an emotional point of view, is really hard to take. And I don't know what emotion you would call that. I don't, because it's not loss. It is separation, but it's more than just a separation, because, you know, I've been separated from somebody before, but you still can feel a connection. And this was just, I don't know what word I would use to describe it, in all honesty.
It's like it is that loss, isn't it? Because and also that having something taken away, or feel like it's being taken away, in terms of like identity, purpose, the stuff that gets us up. What you described to me is what I always say about being a present dad rather than a presence dad, right?
Yeah.
And I've said this on these things and other things numerous times before. When I was married, I was, for all intents and purposes, a weekend dad, but I left the house at 6 a.m. and didn't get home till late at 9 o'clock at night. So I was a weekend dad. But when I was there, I was really engaged. I've always been a really present dad when I'm around. And that was just schematics of our lifestyle, right? But when that's not there, like, it's that grief and that loss of actually not being able to do the thing that brings you joy and passion, and being able to witness those minute daily experiences, like you said, making breakfast, doing the school run, like having a joke with them on the car on the way home, or whatever it might be, checking in, how'd you get on with your homework and stuff like
that. Well, I got into the position as well with my oldest son, where if he was doing something like a school concert, or he had a speech day or something like that, he would actually resent me even turning up.
Mm.
I knew that I had to turn up, because I thought to myself, one day you'll be glad that I did. But he resented me turning up. So the sort of the sense of isolation that I was going through at that point was just, I suppose the way you would say it is that the central architecture was just pulled away from me. And again, I know that leading up to the separation, I had been the one who'd been saying the D word to my ex. But I'd been saying it in the sense of, if we can't get over this problem, if you can't sit here and start to have proper conversations with me, then we have no choice but to divorce. I do not wish to do that. We need to deal with this problem. And then ultimately, again, without going into the details, she pulled the trigger in such a way that I had literally no choice but to pick up the nearest bag of things and leave the house. And that's what I left with. So again, all my things were in the home, all the things that were important to me. As you say, Tom, you know, my books, which are very important to me, I was just cut off from everything. Yeah. I was cut off from a network of support. I was cut off from the friends that I'd had because I was back in England because of the family. I didn't have my friends. I didn't have those things, those everyday life things that you enter into in order to keep going. I had no way of getting them back. I had no contact with my children. It was just everywhere I looked, it was like, you know, first day of the Somme. It was just like, you know, it was just, everything was just carnage around me.
Yeah. Lost at sea.
Very much so. Yeah. Mm. And no system of thought by which to guide myself, which to start to make sense of it all and put it all back together.
Yeah. Okay. You mentioned about the point at which you got referred through to me.
Yeah.
Starting to think about, actually, let's look at what's this new age funny fluffy thing called divorce coaching and who's this
guy? You should have had plaits and been smoking a reefer or something as far as my image was concerned.
Only on a Saturday. So when you got referred to through to me, you hadn't heard of divorce coaching at that stage, I'm imagining.
Not at the point when obviously the law firm explained a little bit about what you did at a 3-point bullet point summary sort of level. But no, I'd never heard of them. And you know, the strange thing is that I've spoken to lots of other people who haven't heard of them. And one of the I'm not suggesting when I say this that it's a role that's directed towards men, but where I think that there's, from what I can see of other people who have gone through this or are going through this, women very often are a lot better at plugging into a support network than men are.
Okay.
And that's not to say that there aren't women out there who also would benefit from a divorce coach. I think, you know, it's horses for courses. But certainly for men struggle, because what happens is men have this thing about, I've just got to put a brave face on and I've got to carry on. We're brought up that way since we're kids, you know, you fall over and you cut your knee. Don't cry about it. Stand up. Don't be a girl.
Yeah.
Things to say to kids, but that's what he said. And so so men aren't great at turning around and saying, I'm really struggling with this. Men might say for 5 minutes at the beginning of a conversation or in the pub or in the coffee shop, they might say, oh God, I've got nightmare, da, da, da. And it's 5 minutes worth of conversation before they turn on to something else. And you don't actually deal with anything.
Yeah.
So, like I say, I'm not saying that it's not something that's also relevant. I'm sure there are many situations where it's relevant for women. But I'm surprised particularly why more men are not aware that services such as yours can really help. I mean, even now, my ex refers to you as being like my counselor, and I think to myself, well, that's not the case. You know, there's a difference between counselor and coach.
Mm-hmm.
And she says it, of course, because it's designed to try and get up my nose. She says it in a way that's sort of demeaning, as if, you know, if I need a counselor, I need somebody to help hold my hand. But it's not that. It's the practical, there's almost like there's a practical emotional guidance. It's not like sort of, you know, sitting there and I just sit there and sat there and moaned to you and you nodded very sagely and went, yes, that's really it. That's not what happens. What happens is that you can say what's going on, and then you can, and I think, again, this probably suits my personality, certainly it probably suits a lot of other men's personality, but you can then sort of begin to break it down and go, right, how am I going to deal with these composite parts? How am I going to move them? It's not counseling. It's not making me a better person or any of those other things. I think it does along the way, but that's what I mean, is that's not the focus of the thing. It's about how do you get the support you need to be able to deal with all those complex things that are happening? And yes, The lawyers will tell you the legal things of what you should be doing. And often the lawyers will assume you understand a lot of the terminology that they use, even or what would happen next in the procedure, because they're doing it every day, all the time.
Yeah.
But sometimes you might understand it from a, okay, I've read the checklist point of view, but what does that actually feel like?
What does that apply?
How does that, what does that, does what does going into a meeting with a CAFCAS officer, for example, feel like? What are the things about how you're best able to use that moment to achieve what you wish to achieve? That those sort of things lawyers can't really tell you. I mean, they can tell you, but they can't help you with it.
Yeah.
And so that's it, it's, I mean, I don't want to sort of get people to think of like divorce coaches, like, you know, because I've told the story that I appeared in front of a divorce coach crazy in a basket of frogs, and all of a sudden you did something fantastically wonderful with my mind, and now I'm fine. It's a lot more about taking where you are, taking what those issues are, and helping you break them down so you, in your own way, in a way that's comfortable to you, can take on board that experience, that understanding, that framework, and use it both to give yourself confidence and rebuild your own confidence back about what it is you're trying to achieve, and also put yourself in the position that you can better deal with what are going to be difficult, hard, emotional impacts along the route of being divorced.
Yeah.
If that makes sense.
Absolutely does. I knew you'd be able to put this more eloquently than I could. You can be my marketing now as well. I'm now really conscious as well that I'm sitting here not sagely smiling, saying yes. So when you had your initial discovery call, you started to understand a little bit more about how this kind of process worked.
My discovery call. I mean, I remember this to this day, and I've told just about everybody that I could ever speak to this about this discovery call, because my actual first call with you was on the telephone, and you said, "I'm at the F1. I'll call you next week." Right, which is great, right? So then that's fine, because I couldn't expect anything more. So then we had a session where, you know, you spoke to me and I spoke to you, and I remember really clearly, I'm sort of half pouring my heart out, and it's coming out in this jumbled mess of thoughts and everything else, and you'd started, because you wanted me to sort of consider, you know, okay, I'm going to send you this to take your way through and that, so you could get some kind of feel for where I am and what degree of self-awareness or otherwise I'd got at this point, right? So all good stuff. But I'm telling you this story, and you went, "Stop. When you do this, does she do that?"
Yeah.
"You say this, you say that."
"Oh, yeah.
"When you ask for this, does she respond like that?"
Yes.
And you said, and I don't want to sort of malign anyone, but you said, "I obviously can't give a proper opinion because I've never met the lady, but it sounds to me as if you're potentially dealing with someone with," I'll just tame it down a little bit, "it's like someone who's got narcissistic tendencies." And you recommended a book to me. In fact, you recommended two books to me. And again, going back to the "I'm not new age, I don't like self-help books." Normally self-help books for me are the kind of things that I leave at train stations. But I, you know, I'm in for a penny, in for a pound. So I bought these two books. And again, before we had had a second call, I start to read them, and my thought processes are self-help books. You know, I'll turn the page, I'll see how far I get. And I got myself a little yellow highlighter in the book. And I thought, you know, I'm going to protect, a bit like when you're at school, there'll be a sentence here, a title here. I think I'm going to. Well, I got this highlighter. I read the two books. I probably read them in a day, and from cover to cover, couldn't read them enough. And by the time I'd finished, I would say 75% of both books were yellow. And so the whole point that I cannot even begin to describe that insight that you had on day one started to unlock a huge issue for me, because I'd got to the point very quickly that now I get it. Okay, I don't deal with it, but now at least I get it. And that was from the very first session, that insight that you brought to the table. I mean, imagine how many conversations I've been having with my lawyers. They're not there. And professionally, I don't think they would even feel comfortable there saying to you, that person's a narcissist. It's just not something they would want to do, because it might get confused with the legal opinion, all the rest of it. They can't help you. They can't give you that sense to unlock something with. And I'm sure other people would have different issues. It's like everyone who speaks to you is going to have an ex who's a narcissist, but they've all got issues.
Yeah.
And that insight was just incredible. Made such a difference.
It's funny when you were talking about that. I suddenly completely recalled that, yes, you did call me when I was at the British Grand Prix, and I was like, car was flying past, and I'm like, can I give you a call on Monday or Tuesday? I completely forgot about that. I see you brought that. I forgot saying, you brought something back for me. That's cool. I like that. You like that memory. Cool. I tell Mother Harper to get off the phone. She'd be like, oh, yes. So as our work kind of progressed over time, over the weeks and months we were working together, was there another, other than kind of book recommendations, what were some of the other kind of takeaways or things that were helping you with emotional process, rebuilding that resilience and confidence, practical advice?
Yeah. So I suppose there was a long phase. And I mean, let's go from the beginning. At the very beginning, the most practical advice you could give was helping me to identify it. And then there was some time that we spent trying to extrapolate, I suppose, what the consequences of that conclusion were in terms of the issues that I was facing and what generally should be my approach to those general things. And that was probably, I'm casting my mind back, Tom, so my memory may not be perfect, but I think that probably that was a large part of the next 2, 3, 4 sessions that we had, was just going through the various issues and identifying what was really happening against that sort of framework. There were lots of things that I was being advised with all the right legal reasons by my lawyers to do. Having conversations with you gave me a greater degree of optionality, because it also gave me some emotional bandwidth, some emotional responses that maybe I didn't have to do something that the lawyers would recommend, because maybe I could choose to deal with that thing differently. Maybe I could find a different way. But I think large parts, I mean, there are very key stages within the legal process where, you know, you or a divorce coach would get to a point where you say, right, now we need to talk about, this is what's going to happen when you go to your first hearing. This is how it's going to look. This is what you need to prepare yourself for. This is what I suggest, how out of your narrative that you told me you presented, da, da, da. And so there's that, and there's second hearings. And if you're unfortunate enough that you've got, you know, meetings with TAFCAS and you've got family court and all those other things. So all those bits that are important. The most important thing I think I found was, going back to what I said before, being in the situation I was in, I was constantly being beaten by issues with my ex around issues with finance, issues unfortunately arising between me and my kids because of what was going on. And I was able to say, look, Tom, knowing what I know, this is my gut response about how I should respond. And you were in a position where you say, okay, don't, that's not good because of X, Y, and Z. And actually, you didn't ever say don't. You just say, well, just I would consider X, Y, and Z, right? And so you gave a different dimension, because again, you can get right into the middle of the whirlwind.
Yeah.
And so having a divorce coach is good, because you can sound it out. I'm not talking about from the legal issue, but what is the emotional journey that you're going on, and recognizing that, and I certainly still to this day struggle as well as I should, to recognize the emotional journey my ex has been on, but certainly to recognize the emotional journey that my kids might be on, and the emotional journey that at least one of them is on, which is, you know, he's effectively, I know, he's that alienated. He doesn't even recognize that he's alienated. He thinks it's his own choice. But anyway, but again, how do I reach out to him? What are the different mechanisms that I can use to reach out to him? How might I be able to break through that distance? So there's, you know, there are things that you said, you advised me, and I took some of them. I developed some of them into other things, as you know, with my videos with the corny music, expressing an idea or a feeling towards, you know, all these things. But there was literally hundreds of those things that were brought to help me deal with the various issues that are being thrown up. Because the thing that people forget is that going through a divorce is not just a legal process.
No.
You know, people tend to think it's a legal process that, you know, you get in and you've got to sort out the house and who gets the best sofa and all those other things. And that's the focus. And indeed, you know, that's where I was. I've got two things. So I've got to sort out finances. I've got to sort out, you know, who gets what. And I've got to sort out access to kids. And that's it. Divorce is a lot more than that. And I don't want to sound over dramatic, but there's a lot of emotional death and a lot of emotional rebirth that goes on in this process. And to be honest, you know, I personally, with my ex, would love a scenario where I never had to see her, never had to speak to her again. However, I say that, but I know that in that process, I still have, not that I want to be to do it, but I still have an emotional response to her, and I'm still, despite it all, I'm still concerned about her, because those things don't just disappear in a puff of smoke. That, you know, the piece of paper's done and off you go. I think the lawyers are great at being able to take you through a process, but divorce is about so much more than that. And if you're not careful, and this is one of the things I'm really grateful for, it's very easy. I've seen it. I could have easily ended up there myself. I like to think that, being the sort of person I am, I wouldn't, but you don't know. You can become hard, callous, and become a different person out of this process. And it's very easy to do. But by having somebody like you there, you're able to manage your way through that, so that you come out not damaged, as much as anybody can be, not damaged, possibly enhanced as a person. But what you certainly don't is you don't develop the emotional callus that, you know, I know I've seen, unfortunately, my brother got divorced, and his emotional callus is so thick you couldn't get a nuclear missile through it. So I certainly didn't want to be like that. I was in danger of that happening to me, because it was the only defense mechanism I had. And this process stopped that from happening to me.
Where do you think I know everything's a hypothetical, but taking that approach, that train of thought, because obviously you witness it in others, where do you worry that you may have got to? How bad do you think it possibly could have changed the very foundations of who and how you operate as a human being?
So you get to the point, going back to what I was saying before, I'm documenting everything, right? You can become incredibly anal if you're doing that. You know, and you can get to the point where every tiny little thing becomes a major issue, and you want to stand your ground and fight the cause. And, you know, and I'm not saying that I got this right. I certainly don't think I got it right, but I got it more right than I would have done. You can certainly get to a situation where what you're showing your kids is someone who's petty and they don't recognize, and it's not. And I think I could have had totally different responses to the alienation from my son, for example, which probably would have made the alienation worse, or I'm not saying it's solved now, but made it less possible to repair moving forward. My younger son could have been more in the crosshairs. I could have fought for the things that I wanted in all the wrong ways, in such a way that, you know, you just basically, pardon it for the podcast, but become an asshole. It's important that when you do this, you don't let that happen to yourself, because none of us want to be like that. But I think without having the support, sometimes it's very easy to spin off and find yourself in a, you know, if you feel that you're always having to defend yourself, what psychologically are you going to do? Psychologically, if you're always having to defend yourself, you're going to build up a wall that says, I don't give a toss, I don't care at all. And that can easily spread. So that becomes almost a mantra. I didn't want to be at a point where I didn't care, but at the same time, I didn't want to be at a point where the act of caring just left me exposed. And again, finding that middle ground is a really important part of what I think you brought to this situation for me.
Thank you. I want to ask you about, and I won't take up too much more of your time, but you've mentioned and kind of already, we've already spoken about, and you pointed out around that efficient combination of legal, emotional support, right? And your lawyers, fantastic at what they do in the legal field, and they're also very progressive enough to go, actually, that part's not my wheelhouse, go and talk to this chap, right? So do you think that there is a need within the emotional market space that actually this service is something that really should be incorporated into, or is it somehow included with the lawyers?
So I would make a couple of points, and one of them's sort of half in jest, but quite serious too. Now, I was using my lawyers to such an extent, and their charge out rates are not cheap. And I think if somebody turns around and goes, "Oh, you know, you're gonna pay X to have Tom's services," there you go. Oh, that's expensive. But when you think that the alternative is what you might use with lawyers, you're probably a third, you know, if not less. I genuinely think that the law firms will have a lot of clients who, in different circumstances, but in the same place as myself. I genuinely think that any decent law firm of any caliber should be having and talking to their clients, saying, we recognize where you are. The emotional stuff is not our wheelhouse. In terms of best client service to you, we would recommend, you know, Tom or a person doing the same role, or another. Yeah, so I think, you know, there's a lot of firms out there, really good firms, I'm sure, are not even yet in themselves necessarily familiar with the sort of benefits that you can bring to their clients. But I genuinely think that any decent law firm should, you know, they're very good at sending you out the terms of reference. They're very good at sending you out the divorce pack, what we need to know, and all these other things. In there, they should be saying, you're going to find this journey from a legal perspective, we can support you, but you're going to find this journey emotionally very difficult, highly likely that you're going to have issues that are hard to wrestle with. You don't have to take this person up on a rope, but go and have a taster, talk to this person, see if they can help you, because we think you're going to get something to support you in this process. And I think they should be saying that to all their clients.
Yeah. I mean, it's something I'm trying to incorporate into their onboarding as well. And I think that it's about giving. So what you said earlier, when you didn't have the support network, right? You didn't have the friends nearby because they're all overseas. You didn't have much family. Like, you didn't have that around you. And it's about building a team around people of legal, emotional, and financial. I mean, with you, it's a bit different. You're in the world of finance, and you know your numbers, so you didn't necessarily need that. But it's about giving clients the pillars that can help keep them propped up whilst that they get through this. I appreciate that. I really do. That's nice to hear. Cool. All right. Well, let's close it off with one last piece then. In your own words, if somebody out there is listening to this, hopefully they are, somebody out there is listening to this or watching this, what advice would you give as someone who has lived and breathed this for very deeply for quite a while?
So I think, again, I have to say a little bit about my own circumstances. So I was in the middle of, and I'm sure there are people out there who have had worse, but I was in the middle of a really horrible divorce process. And what I would say is it's very easy to lose sight of what is really going on. It's very easy to find yourself just unable to emotionally make sense of it all. I mean, logically, you can do that, but emotionally make sense of it all. I would say the most important thing is, as I think I said already, is to remember all the time that divorce is more than just a process. And don't think that by looking at the process and having the lawyers drive a process that somehow you're dealing with divorce, because you're not. That's what I would leave it with.
Put it better myself. That was awesome. Cool. All right. Well, thank you so much for sharing your time, your experience. It wasn't that I want to make you re-traumatized through it. But, I really, really do appreciate it. The world needs to hear more stories, more people's experiences. We always go to and hear and assume the car crash stories and the really hard ones, but there are still good things that come for people, even in the most difficult of situations. And like seeing the change in you from when I very first started working with you as well is exactly why I do this. I really appreciate your time. Thank you very much for joining us. For anybody that is listening, if you want to find out a little bit more about Vols Coaching, how it works, either with me or if you'd like me to connect you with somebody else, you can find me anywhere online. If you just Google Mr. Vols Coach, I'm on Instagram, LinkedIn, anywhere online. And you can also, if you're interested in working with me, I do offer all clients a 45-minute free consultation online or potentially in person if geographics work. Just lastly, again, thank you very much for your time, Andrew. I really, really appreciate it, you joining us today. Thank you again.